Welcome to episode 2 of This Catholic Life. Conversations about life's ups and downs, big and small, how we deal with every situation imaginable, whatever life throws at us, but still manage to be sensible, practical, and joyful. That's going to be a challenge today, because today's show is called You Give Love a Bad Name, which is about those Catholics and things, the events in news which give us a bad name. That is not just Catholics, but Christians in general, and in particular the institutional church in Australia. I'm your host, Peter Holmes, and today I'm joined by Renee Coleryan, Professor in Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. Hello, Renee.
Hi, Peter.
And by Cormac McCann, who's making his debut as a co-host here on This Catholic Life. Hello, Cormac.
Hello, a very risky move by you, Peter.
This podcast is designed to be a series of conversations on how we deal with everyday life but still manage to maintain our Christian identity, and mostly a discussion of what that actually means, what our Christian identity is. We aim to chat about how each of us manage to muddle through everyday life and achieve joy through this Catholic life. Joy, I don't mean giggling sort of pretense at happiness, but genuine deep satisfaction and sense of purpose in what we do and a fulfillment in that sense. This topic is not lending itself, though, to happy conversations because it's about who gives us a bad name. Perhaps we should have another show on who gives us a good name, but hopefully that'll come up as we discuss this. Before we get stuck into the conversation, let's talk about this week. My week's been pretty crazy getting lessons ready for semester 2, particularly the marriage and sexuality class, which is going to be some of the things we touch on in the show today. Cormac, how's your week been?
Yeah, it's been pretty good. My wife and I are actually in the process of securing our first home, which is really exciting and terrifying.
Yes.
There's a steep learning curve in terms of, you know, loans and paperwork and negotiations and strategies and and that kind of all fell on my shoulders because my wife was very beautiful and said, Cormac, I delegate this all to you.
It's been wonderful. The secret of a happy marriage, delegation.
That's right. I'm learning this slowly, she says, and I do.
I have been at my desk all this last week having a wonderful time putting together an online program, which is the Human Person in Catholic Thought. And I had my first online classroom this last week. I was a little bit nervous about it, but we had a great time talking with teachers.
You can just pretend you're on a podcast.
I know. It was probably good training, the earlier podcast. So I had teachers from across New South Wales talking about wonderful things, which I might get back to with our moment of wonder later on.
Indeed. Let's dive right in then to the hard issues. Today's topic is You Give Love a Bad Name, not the Bon Jovi song, although I would have killed to have the rights to play that as our intro today, but what it is that give Christians a bad reputation in the world, what it is that puts people off about Christians, what are the things we say, do or don't do that make people suspicious, skeptical, or even downright mad with us. And it's becoming much more evident, I've noticed, in response to lots of public things lately, the hostility towards the church, and people who've not actually met an active Christian recently or something, they feel that there's an outright hostility towards things Catholic in particular. It seems to be the Catholics is a brand, if you like, that they recognise as the bad guys. We're going to talk about the things in the media, public scandals, church leaders, right down to things in the local parish. But let's start with the big obvious elephant in the room, the public scandals, because that's what is in everyone's face. It's very much what people are talking about, particularly in relation to Catholicism. You can't go past the sexual abuse scandals as the biggest thing that it gets waved in our face as soon as we talk. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but any time I'm talking to people who aren't Catholics, almost always you can count on a counter comment in Facebook or in conversation, people will drop a nasty comment about child molestation and about this being the worst institution in the world for all these sorts of things. Is that your experience?
It actually isn't.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, we are. It's interesting. It's.
I want to meet your friends.
Yeah, well, yeah, very fortunate in the circles I mix in. No, I've had a number of really interesting encounters with. In my previous job, I worked for the New South Wales government, and it was always a really interesting point of engagement where definitely not a practicing community in any terms of faith, but. Interestingly, I used to take my rosary beads to work every day, do like the rosary on the bus, and then I would leave them at my desk sometimes. I would just forget.
Sure.
And I remember coming to work one morning and I'd found that the rosary beads had been moved from my computer, from my work desk, and moved to the center of the meeting room on a table spread out. And you imagine these just big rosy beads just sitting there on the table. They're beautiful rose color, very, very lovely. And you could just imagine just a group of people just standing around like a bunch of seagulls eyeing off a chip or something like going, what on earth is this? And who's going to pick it up? And
this religious relic.
That's right. And so, but that was actually a starting point to a conversation with a number of them who then came up and said, look, we noticed this. What is it? What's it all about? And there was a polite curiosity. And I think that's how I would describe most of the encounters that I've had. Some people may know a few things from the media and things like that, but I'd say that the realm of social media and the realm of actual human experience engaging with people one-on-one are very disparate in terms of their attitudes towards the church.
You've had obviously secular people and others interacting. What about you, Renee? Have you had?
Mainly, I suppose, my life these days is fairly Catholic. So most of the students that I have would be Catholic. And some are not Catholic, and some of them are really openly curious, I think, in the way that you're talking about, Cormac, which is nice. I think there might be some advantages to being in a so-called post-Christian age.
Right.
Because
what do you mean by that, sorry?
Because there's a lot of talk these days about the fact that we've gone through a kind of, an age of Christendom, then an age of secularism where people kind of still knew what Christianity was, but they were really turning against it. And now I think we're actually at a point where people don't even know what Christianity is anymore.
Right.
But that becomes a new opportunity to start explaining to ourselves.
Because
first
it's a blank
slate. Yeah. So it's like I think of our era now as very much like Augustine's era, where we're looking at the pagans again and we love them and we want to show them, and we can be very pagan ourselves too. Let's not forget that. Mm. But let's just renew the understanding of what it means to be Christian, what it means to be in Christ. It's a huge challenge.
It's interesting you
say
that.
But it's quite exciting.
Because the pagan thing is, they're not really pagan in the proper sense of the ancient idea of pagan, but in the sense of being
non-religious. In many ways they are.
Okay.
Yeah, I think New Ageism is basically paganism, and lots of people are New Agey these days.
Come
and they
up
don't
to the
realize
Blue Mountains.
Just,
yeah, you'll see. Yeah, you'll see this.
Okay.
Yeah, and just people who just as a matter of course are going into Buddhist meditation and yoga because that's the thing you do. That's paganism.
I'm spiritual but not religious.
Yeah,
kind of
that's
mentality.
Right. Okay. So I think that that's actually a huge opportunity for us in many ways. There's probably more openness now, particularly I'm looking at the young man to my right here, in your generation, Cormac, but also in the others, sort of high schoolers now, who are curious about the interesting things that go on in Christianity.
I get an impression, Renee, that you're absolutely right. When I'm talking to people who haven't had an experience of church, you're really dealing with a blank slate, except for the image they've got via the media and
right.
other things like that. But on the other hand, sometimes we as Christians act and think as if it's still a Christian culture, as if we're surprised that certain things happen in Parliament or in schools or things like that, because we're sort of half expecting everything to be Christian still. And I think we're long beyond that.
I'm astonished that anything is Christian anymore.
Right.
So I'm coming from the opposite extreme. It's like any little bit in there is amazing.
Right.
Because I think that the whole fabric of what it actually means to be Christian has been so corroded that it's amazing if anything gets through. It's through the grace of God and the work of a lot of really good people that anything remains. So I'm coming from the opposite extreme.
I'm having this discussion with you and a friend of mine who we argue about who's an optimist and who's a pessimist. And I now know where
I'm a realist.
Yeah, Renee's always very cheerful, and now I know why, because anything she sees is a plus. Wow.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, my gosh, that works.
They're not killing each other today. That's
right.
Amazing.
Yeah.
We come back to the actual public persona. Presentation, though, of the faith. And I have to say that when we're talking about things like religious freedom, I was standing on the sideline of my son's soccer game talking to other mums and dads, very good people. Like, we've really enjoyed their company over a long period of time, a couple of years now. And yet when the issue came up about religious freedom, absolutely, straight out the bat, no, all Catholics should be silenced. They should actually outlaw Catholicism. It's a perverse and corrupting institution. It's basically harming all these kids, and that's all it's good for, and there's no good they've ever done. It was so absolute across the board in these people, so violently anti-Catholic. And I was attempting very gently to say, well, hang on, maybe there's some people who aren't quite that bad, and it just simply wasn't accepted. So I've had a similar experience from people, and I play on online community, so I come across lots of people, various views, various stages of life, various identifications in terms of sexuality, and they're all, they usually have an idea of Catholicism that they're reacting to, like a perception of it. And I have to say that it hasn't helped the public image of Catholicism that we have actually verified court, you know, court cases that have found guilty, you know, priests, bishops, and I think more insidiously, institutional cover-ups. I think that's actually, I mean, people do bad things and that's horrible. It should never happen. But the fact that an institution where people in the institution who weren't afflicted by this particular perversion, who weren't afflicted by that particular, you know, sort of irrational urge to hurt someone, but they covered that up and they actually harmed the victims even worse and, you know, prevented recovery for these victims because they denied the situation. That makes me, makes my blood boil. You mentioned before I look angry at the start of this podcast. I am angry because I have children and some of my non-Catholic friends look at me and say, how can you do this? You know, how can you defend the church? I'm not defending the church on this. This is abysmal.
I do think that there needs to be a distinction made, though, and probably that's something that as a Catholic I've come to realise more and more. There's the institutional church, which I tend to think has become very, very bureaucratic.
Yes.
And so it's taken on all of the ways that the modern state can really swallow up individuals and not listen to them and just cover up everything and legalise everything.
And I think institutions that is shameful. Tend to defend themselves, don't
they? That's right. And so there's that. But then there is the church that is the broken, wounded body of Christ.
Yes.
And actually unifying ourselves with Christ in that respect is a huge challenge when the institutional face of the church, which everyone identifies as the church.
Yes.
So everyone thinks, oh, the church is St. Peter's and your archdiocesan offices and your schools and your hospitals and everything else. But as a Catholic, if you realize that, no, that's not the only aspect of the church, it becomes even more of a challenge to find one's place as a Catholic.
So should we ditch the Pope and the bishops and all that?
Absolutely not, because that's part of the sacramental reality. So that's part of the living presence of Christ in the world.
Yeah.
But again, it's a broken living presence of Christ
in
the world.
This seems to be the big point, isn't it? The fact that the problem seems to have been that people were either perpetuating or they bought an image of church as being a perfect ideal.
Yeah.
That if there's any sort of blip in the radar that says Catholics, the priest or the hierarchy or any part of the church was not pure or not good in real life, that they kind of, we got to keep the image up. Whereas in fact, if we had a full understanding of the church being a broken place, we could perhaps own that brokenness and go, right, now it's broken, let's bring healing to that situation.
Or if we actually just stopped talking about the church as though it was this perfect thing and talked about the church as the bride of Christ who was always trying to overcome all of the obstacles of original sin through living through and with Christ.
G.K. Chesterton, sorry, go on.
No, but even getting that down to the personal level, you talk of this attitude of the church as institution is supposedly perfect and that's the attitude people have. I think sometimes Catholics can have that unrealistic expectation on themselves at an individual level.
Yes.
It's like, I've done the wrong thing. Oh, I'm a wicked person. How can I possibly recover from this at all? And I think that, I don't know, that really negative mindset of the self as needing to attain perfection all the time you know, meet that expectation is also problematic.
Especially in the young Catholics who have sort of gone countercultural against society and they've gone, no, I'm going to reject that whole pagan thing or whatever it is and become, you know, really take my religion seriously and they get into it and they're so passionate about it. Then when they fall, like even in a small way, they suddenly go, oh, and there's a identity crisis. Am I really good enough Catholic? They almost repeat the institutional problem, which is they try and cover up the flaws rather than actually confront them and deal with them. We have to say, though, that not just the actual flaws and the actual perceptions of the problem here, we have out there quite established situations where the church has fundamentally failed to protect the people in the institution. That has to be, if you like, put on the table in all its ugliness and faced and dealt with. We have to bleed that out, if I can put it that way, I think. And honestly, any attempt to defend institutions and say, we're not quite as bad. At one stage, I went into all the stats and Catholic Church is much less per capita than other churches. It's much less per capita than the Scouts and all that sort of thing. And you go, well, doesn't matter. You
know, happening at all.
No, zero. So, zero is the acceptable.
Zero is the acceptable thing.
We just don't want to go there at all. We cannot use excuses. And the tu quoque argument, you know, you're doing it too. That's not good enough.
No.
It's not good enough. We have to look at ourselves first and go, this guy has to change, and the way we deal with institutions, and we can't be making excuses for this ever. And in a sense, what frustrates me about this is that people have, if you like, put solutions out there which aren't necessarily solutions for the problem. It seems to me that all the people arguing about clericism, about having married priests, about all these kinds of solutions to this are exact. I've actually gone back through my emails. They're exactly the same people who were saying the same things before the crisis hit many, many years ago, and they've a new, you know, this new crisis as if smashed into the world, and they're using it as a catalyst for their own political agenda. Mm. What that annoys me about that is it doesn't respect the victims themselves, because they're not actually interested in helping the victims. They're using the momentum of it to push a particular agenda. Because all the stats say, by the way, that married priests doesn't actually affect the abuse. In fact, it's a slightly higher rate of sexual misconduct among married clergy in the world than Catholic priests, sorry, than celibate priests. That doesn't, it's not a good argument for one thing or another, but I'm just saying, I think that using the victims as a means of political capital is a really dangerous thing. You're seeing it in Parliament a little bit, because the voice of Catholicism has been against things like euthanasia and other things in Parliament, and they use the whole, you watch someone try and stand up and say something about euthanasia now, the pedophilia put down for anyone who's a Catholic comes out, and it's totally irrelevant to the argument, but it gets used as a put down. It doesn't respect the victims. We actually need to be helping the victims.
But that's the new world of social capital, right? You know, the church has really lost its ground on that natural respect that it used to.
Yeah, it's that capital of trust, right?
Yeah, yeah,
the Catholic Church is important, not the trusted word. Organization.
Yeah, important word, trust, because it used to be that people, even if they weren't Catholic, they at least expected a certain level of behavior from a priest.
Yeah.
And nowadays it's almost the opposite. Yeah. They almost expect or believe in advance accusations against a priest or someone who's a public Catholic figure. Well, let's not dwell on this too much, but let me throw the clericism thing out there. Is there a perception that clerics, by that we mean priests and bishops, and that they have, what is clericism? I mean, how would we define it? That they have an undue influence, that they... I mean, they have an influence.
That they can do no wrong?
They can do no wrong. So putting
on
a pedestal.
They are the authority figures on everything, and anything that they say goes, because they are the authority figures. And I think that has been.
Yeah.
I've certainly seen that as a huge problem. I just read yesterday an open letter written by a victim over in the US, and it was an awful read, but she basically named all of the clerics who had failed her.
Yes.
And she said exactly in which ways they had. So it was an awful thing
to
read.
So some of those were.
And some of those were, well, you abused me, you covered it up, you told me it was my fault. These are all people, different people. Yeah, different people. You told me that all of this was going to be resolved, and that the person who had done this to me would be made responsible for it. That didn't happen. Not only did it not happen, but I know that this person went on to abuse others.
Yes.
And nothing was done about that. I know that some of those have come forth, but some of them have not, because they've been frightened to seeing what happened to me when I tried to do, and it's ruined my life.
Yes.
So, and basically that letter really, I think, brought to the fore what you're asking about with clericism or clericalism, which is that she trusted in the institutional presence of the cleric and thought that that was the safe place to go, and it was the most unsafe place possible to go.
Although,
and then
the
question
have
becomes,
the
it
safe
should
place.
Have been the safest place, and then the question becomes, well, where is she supposed to go?
Yes.
And there is nowhere for her to go because people aren't listening to her.
Yep.
And I think the other side of clericalism is, and this has come up in the abuse cases within Australia, say 40 or 50 years ago, young child comes home, says, "Mum, this is what happens." Happened, and the mum says, "Well, no, father never would have done that.
Yep.
You bad boy, you're lying." What a horrible, horrible, horrible situation. I think that it is a huge. It has been a huge problem. Hopefully it's one that we're overcoming.
Well, I mean, certainly the steps are in the right direction, but we're still seeing a recalcitrance in terms of actually making the right steps. In some respects, we've gone a little bit too far, and I think institutional solutions are not going to solve the problems that institutions
got. That's what I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do we do about it, and what's the... is it the root cause of the problem?
I mean, having a workshop that says how you deal with children helps a good person be a good person, right? Having a workshop on how to behave around children doesn't stop someone who has bad urges and bad bad decision making and bad moral problems, it doesn't stop them. It just enables them to get around those problems. However, what it can do is set up an institutional response which is a bit more awake to the problems and actually more likely to take seriously the victims. I hope so anyway. And I've seen it happen, and I think we're getting there. We're certainly, the Catholic Church are leading the way in these kinds of solutions. They're certainly up there with some of the best in the world at the moment. But we're still, I mean, this has taken years, like decades to come out, the problems have. So I think we're going to have to wait decades to see solutions. But Catholics aren't the only ones causing us a bad name. And often if people aren't Christian at all, if they've had no experience, they'll often look at anyone who identifies as a Christian and kind of lump that in the same basket. So what about other people who say that they're Christian and give us a bad name? Can you think of any examples?
Donald Trump.
Oh, we went there. That's good. That's right. Now, there are some Christians, let's be fair, there are some Christians who would say he's the Savior, not the Savior, but he's a Savior, because they see him as the answer to the kind of anti-life, anti-specifically religious freedom in the States. So you've mentioned Donald Trump as a possible.
Well, absolutely. I just think that he's used in the media as a way of further entrenching that image of anyone who's publicly professes Christianity in whatever level of belief,
yep,
regardless of, you know, public practice or whatever, proposes to be pro-life, anti-euthanasia, right, things like that. And you go, well, okay, well, this is the best public candidate you've got, you know, yep, and he's tarnished in the media every other day. It's just kind of, yeah, I've just picked it as an example of
something. I saw a meme on when they were having the gay marriage debate in the States, and the meme said, "I'm sorry that my gay marriage undermines your fourth marriage." in terms of that, it was a meme about Donald Trump.
Yeah. Yes.
In other words, if you're going to espouse something, it helps to have actually lived that thing.
That's right. The character matters of the individual.
Yeah.
And that's why I brought him up.
I actually think Donald Trump's problem goes a little bit further than that. I think that he's claiming a religious sort of underpinning to his ideas, and some of the ideas that he's pushing quite hard are profoundly anti-Christian, I think. The treatment of people coming across, you know, genuine refugees, the treatment of people who have been in the States for a long time but just don't have the right kind of heritage or you know, colour or whatever, and the encouragement of that particular kind of behaviour, I think is profoundly unchristian and should not be given a Christian label, if you like. Mm. However, I mean, and again, the situation is not black and white, and that's the trouble, I think, with modern ideas, that you put one person up and say, this is the Christian candidate, almost never works, because it's not going to, I mean, our recent election, some people were saying one side's the Christian one and the other side. And then I heard both arguments coming from different places.
It's very difficult to vote as a Catholic, but I think that that's probably where we're always stuck, right? Whenever I do one of those, the ABC online, where do you sit and who should you be voting for? I'm always the center. So if I want to go for the social issues, it's going to be more the Liberal Party. But even until recently, I was not very happy with what was going on there.
No.
And I certainly wasn't happy with what was going on with Labor, but I'm probably more Labor economically, but always right at the center. So it becomes really, really tricky to figure out what to do.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
I wrote a post, actually, Dear Labor, after the election, and I basically said, please stop deliberately targeting Christians and having a go at our religious freedoms and having a go at these social issues, because I'd really love to get on board with some of your other ideas in terms of, you know, the minimum wage and the treatment of the vulnerable and all of those kinds of things. But it's really hard, because as soon as I step into your fray, you're basically saying, you're unwelcome, you get out of here, because we don't like your retrograde views. And if you're not going to be a broader church and at least permit that sort of voice, you've basically written a whole bunch of people off. I'm not terribly happy with where the Liberal Party's dealing with either. But I think, Renee, what you said before is very important, that it should be agony to vote. Because when someone says it's an easy choice, I think you're not really thinking about this.
Yeah.
You haven't really thought through all of the big issues here, because none of them are worthy of an unquestioned Christian vote, in my opinion. What about televangelists and people who present themselves quite clearly as being, you know, the pristine kind of schmick Christians on telly, usually asking for money of some kind?
I must admit to not having had too much truck with televangelists, probably because I don't have television. That would be a
valid reason.
All right, so I asked the wrong person.
That's right. Cormac, over to you. You must have television.
Even then, more limited experience. It's like, you know, when you're chasing toddlers around the place, if the only sacred time that you'll get for the, you know, the devil's altar, as Fulton Sheen calls it, the TV, is hopefully Friday night footy. So, but the Sunday morning televangelists, however, I have sat and watched a few episodes of some of them, and I can't or won't name any particular examples. However, I do get the general sense of this kind of notion of the prosperity gospel.
Yeah.
This idea that we're sending a message out that your life is difficult, life is suffering, life is trouble. But if we look to this particular verse of scripture, you can see that you can apply this directly to your life and something's going to happen in the near future. You don't know when, but God is going to, I remember this phrase, he's going to shoot you out, because it was some reference to a bow and arrow or something in the Old Testament. It's like, and it's going to happen, and you're all, and everyone's there and they're getting on their feet. Now, I don't know, maybe it'll happen, but
there's no such promise in scripture that you'll suddenly be prosperous. But it's a very attractive message if you're saying to someone, your life is crap, here's a way that it's going to become instantly better if you become Christian. And that's not a new thing. It's been happening for some time. If you do this, the payoff will be that. Some time ago now, but there was a movie called Leap of Faith with Steve Martin in it. And he actually modeled his character in that movie. He was a televangelist in the movie, Con Man. And he modeled it on a televangelist who's still on television today. It's worth going to look at the movie because he does a really good job of sort of showing the glitz and glam, and then in the movie he has an encounter with an actual spiritual experience, and it's quite an interesting movie. What about other Christians like sportsmen? I'll throw the name Israel Folau in there. We're going to be talking about religious freedom in another episode, but the fact that he came out and said this particular meme that he threw around, which seemed to send quite a lot of people, not just homosexuals, but quite a lot of other people, fornicators, liars. Well, there's a whole list from the Book of Revelation.
Drunkards, things like that.
Drunkards, yes, and which covers most of his team, I would suggest.
Now.
Well, this is what amused me at the start, is that I thought, well, hang on, how is it that only homosexuality is getting pinned out of this whole list, when in fact there's quite a long list in this thing, and all the others seem comfortable with this criticism? But an atheist friend of mine said, Peter, it's different because none of those people would say that drunkenness or adultery or idolatry, only those things, none of them would say they're good things, whereas they would say in modern society that homosexuality is okay, that it's good, it's not a sin in itself, whereas all the others most people would recognize and go, yeah, okay, it's not great to be drunk, it's not great to be a liar, it's not great to be a cheat.
I'd even go further. I think that it's actually that with all of these issues of sexual identity, with whether it be homosexuality or transgender, I know that they're very different from each other actually, but they've been recognised as the vulnerable group.
Yes.
And if you see the church as actually victimising vulnerable populations, then they just become the next vulnerable population that the Catholics are persecuting.
Well, in fairness—
And the Christians are persecuting.
In fairness, all the stats in terms of mental health and you know, all the negative outcomes to do with life and victimisation measure up to say these communities do suffer a great deal, the jury's out on who's actually causing the suffering, but there is definitely, they are in fact vulnerable. There's no doubt about it. And there is a genuineness. And just throwing an accusation at someone, even if you justify it by saying it's a Bible verse, is not a terribly good thing. I was saying to Renee the other day, Cormac, that if I had have spouted that line in my classroom at Notre Dame, Renee might have had a conversation with me to say, maybe this isn't the way to go about this.
Well, interestingly, in The Australian, I think a little while ago, Greg Sheridan made the point that the terminology, so Israel Folau apparently took a passage from one of St. Paul's letters and just kind of transcribed it into everyday speak. But the term homosexuality actually refers to— everything else refers to a practice. It's something you do. You go and you get drunk. You fornicate, you lie and everything else. Whereas homosexuality is something, it's same-sex attraction. So that's actually a different kind of thing. It's not an
accurate translation of the word.
No. So there were all sorts of issues with the tweet in itself. And I think that was a really astute point.
So it was an identity thing rather than an action.
Yeah, that's right.
Fair enough.
Yeah. That's because we all sin. We all do the wrong thing. Peter Singer came out and said, you know, according to Israel Folau, this was an interesting moment in public discourse in Australia. So Peter Singer said, well, if you look at what Israel Folau believes, then he was exactly right. So this is Peter Singer with his perfect logic. He was absolutely logically correct to say, I want to warn these people that they will go to hell because this is what I think. So this is my act of love, if you will, to these people. And that's where I see it coming from. And that's where it becomes more of a religious freedom issue.
If I could sit down with Israel, I would probably say to him, talk about it, how effective it is, because I've never heard of anybody changing their mind from being abused or being told that they're wrong or something. So, I mean, if you see someone who's suffering, I have a dear friend who was an alcoholic, and if you say to them, alcohol's ruining your life,
it's not very helpful.
It's not very helpful. Either they're going to deny it or they're going to say, yeah, well, so what? You've got to actually provide an alternative. Yeah. And so what do you say to someone who has genuine same-sex attraction? This isn't something they invent.
No.
We've got to have something more to say. We've got to actually have – firstly, we've got to listen for a very long time and understand the vulnerability and actually respond in kind. So in other words – it can be about impression. Now, Renee and I have both experienced people who are very keen, young Catholics, especially young Catholics and of various ethnicities who are very keen to get out there and save souls, but what they actually mean is win arguments.
Yeah.
And they get and this is bringing it down to a more local level. And when I became a Catholic, I was often asked to go on into debates with Baptist ministers or, you know, Anglican ministers or whatever. And I always said no, because I've never met anyone who's gone to one of these debates and changed their mind, or who felt that they received some edifying benefit from that debate. Now, apologetics has a place, but it's not evangelization. And I don't think we win anyone over.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, I think there's certainly among younger people, there's a certainly younger practicing Catholics. People are trying to work out, well, how do I, you know, there's a zeal to really contribute to the life of the church, and they want to be involved and they want to be active in their parish. They want to do good things. You know, they want a particular kind of liturgy perhaps.
Yep.
But there's, when it comes down to the practical thing about what do you do to reach out to people who are either sitting on the fence or vehemently against what you believe, how do you engage with them? And I can see there's a real split among different youth groups, for example, where some think, no, you've got to smash them hard, you know, we're going to win this argument and that's how you convert. It worked in the Crusades, we can work again.
Yeah, kind of. It worked so well then.
They haven't actually looked at the history.
That's right. A little bit of history might help there. I used to have one student who would come up to me and say, give me the silver bullet argument, Professor, give me the silver bullet. And I'd say, there is no silver bullet. You have to live your life in a really good way and look for the arguments that make sense of what's going on in your life. But there is no silver bullet that you could just, you know, shoot this argument to someone, they'd say, oh my gosh, you're totally right. Yes. There's a whole lot more to the way that we actually respond to things in the world.
And that's about being human, because each individual human is an incredibly complex set of experiences and background, education, and all those sorts of things. We have to actually listen to someone for quite some time before we learn their language, and we can actually firstly hear their hurts and their dreams and their hopes and all those sorts of things. And then perhaps we can add something of a perspective from our experience, which might help them along the journey. And also the one-shot argument which converts someone is not a very Catholic concept.
No, not at all.
It's always a journey getting to the end, and we can help people in that journey.
Yeah, I can share one brief story about that actually, if you like, back in the government, I remember there was this one woman, let's call her Joanna for argument's sake, and she was, you know, in her perhaps late 40s, early 50s, divorced and turned up to work at 9, went home at 4:30, and that was all she wanted. She wasn't really interested in doing anything, you know, advancing anywhere.
Yep.
And it was as if someone had stapled, you know, her lips downwards.
Right.
So she was in a perpetual frown. Like that was always and I always used to be curious about that. So I made it my mission every single morning to go up and, you know, and make Joanna laugh. That was my goal. I just make her smile, make her laugh, say something ridiculous or do whatever. And I did this every day. And after a few weeks, perhaps a month or two, she just stopped me one morning and said, Cormac, why are you so happy? What do you take every morning? Where
Tell
can I get
the
some?
Right. That was the silver bullet.
But then I explained, wow, you know, life's awesome. I've got a lot to be grateful for, a lot to look forward to.
Yep.
And she's like, well, why do you think that? You know, isn't like property really expensive? How's young people supposed to survive in this world? You know, what's going on? And I was like, oh, no, I'm really hopeful. I'm not really attached to owning stuff because I know I'm going to die one day and you know, what's going to count is what I've done.
Yes.
You know, and so I try and, yeah, I just said words to that effect essentially, and you just saw something switch in her mind.
Yeah.
You know, like a light just turned on. And I remember after that moment, every other day, she was just bouncier. She came in, she engaged more. She was, yeah, something had, some. I can't say what it was or whether it was actually even directly related to what I did at all, but yep. You certainly noticed there's a definite transformation. And we've had a few really interesting conversations since then. And so, you
good.
Know, yeah, but that's the kind of thing that I think is really what sets, what should set, I think, Catholics, especially young Catholics who are looking for what we're supposed to be doing in the world, you know, how we're supposed to convert people. Man, just be joyful.
Yes.
Be joyful, be excited.
Joy is a big deal. And when I did a bit of a study about how parents retain their kids in the faith, I found out firstly it's about the kids, not about the parents necessarily. But one of the common themes that came through wasn't their fidelity or their religious practice, but it was their joy.
Mm.
If they had joy in the faith, if there was joy in the home, the kids then associated all of the religious practice and the understandings as lived experience rather than just these are the principles and but look at what it was like really. It was just strict or boring or, you know, too restrictive or something. But if there's joy, it actually, you know, keeps people interested. And if people look at joy, I think World Youth Day was a good example of that in Sydney. People looking around going, wow, all the things we thought about religion and all these religious people coming to town. I was in Denver and a Muslim cab driver picked me up to take me to the diocese and I said I was going to the Catholic headquarters and he said, oh, yeah, Catholics, there was a bunch of them in town some years ago because he remembered
Denver,
World Youth Day.
Yeah.
That there were all these happy young people and he couldn't get over the fact that they were all happy. That was a lot of this, though, is a function, I think, of bad understanding of the faith. So we talked about all those enthusiastic young people wanting to do the right thing by their faith, but they're misdirected because they've been given an idea of what the faith is. You have to win this argument or you have to believe this perfectly, otherwise you can't do that. And there's
standing
even,
for that principle matters more than engaging with them at a human level. Kind of.
And there's some people who get mortally offended that someone else approached communion. This is almost the, you know, the classic situation of Christ talking to the Pharisee and the tax collector. But, oh, that person went to communion and I know they're not living right. And you go, well, okay, what was happening in your heart when you were in that mass?
Mm.
Like as you're, you know, were you focused on Christ? Were you focused on your place before Christ and the grace he has for your life, for your sins, for your struggle to be that? Or were you worried, you know, you're so focused on someone else that you, and the purity of that, that you miss the whole point of the entire mass? That bad theology, I think, comes because I'm going to get a bit controversial here and say it's easier. It's easier to boil everything down to one thing or a couple of things. It's easier to not have to think in not vague, but a more complex system of thought. What do you think? Is that, am I oversimplifying it there?
No, I don't think so. What's coming to my mind is a gospel passage, and you're the scripture scholar, so you can tell me which one it is, Peter. You know, Catholics and
now
the Bible.
You put me on the spot.
It's in there somewhere.
That's right.
I've heard it before.
Well, it's when Christ, it struck me, it was just this week. So Christ sends out the 12 apostles and they're all named,
mm-hmm.
and he says, don't go out to the pagans, go to the Jews.
Yes.
And it struck me as I thought strategic operator. That was the first thing that clicked in my mind. But, but I thought go to the people who kind of understand some of the language.
Yes.
And open it up and make it alive for them.
Yes.
And I think that that's actually part of the mission of the church today or the believers today, to actually reach those people who are hurting and wounded within the church, to help to make communities alive with the love of Christ in whichever way that looks.
And also in the Jewish community, one of the key factors of evangelization was that they were hopeful. They were looking for the Messiah.
Yeah.
They were already looking out for, whereas a lot of the Greeks didn't even know that they needed one.
No, that's right. And yeah, so the Jews are actively alert and looking, and then if you hear, well, here he is.
Mm.
I think there are little ways in which we could probably do that a lot better ourselves, so that we become better witnesses and more joyful witnesses together. So we're not, that's one of the big scandals I find within the church, besides everything else that hits the headlines, is that there's so much lack of unity.
Right.
So Christ is calling us all to be one.
Yep.
I was looking at this with my students we're supposed to be like the unity of the Trinity, which is also a multiplicity. So why are we arguing about liturgy why are we arguing about, you know, and that's something we could have a whole podcast about that, right? Mm-hmm. The different lay movements within the church, you know, well, mine's better than yours, or I'm not going to name any of them. You all know who, we all know who we are. And then you've got the mainstream Catholic who's just like, can I just go to Mass?
Yes.
And have a beautiful liturgy where my heart is rising to God and I'm with everyone else. Can I just have an hour of that beautiful peace? Please.
Yes.
Stop bringing your turf war warfare into our liturgy.
But you said that, you said that's exactly the point, because it's not just about us choosing those different groups. Often the different ideas of church get forced upon us.
Yeah.
So you go to some parishes and you'll get a particular agenda coming through, or a particular kind of thing coming at you, as if this is the only way to be Catholic,
yeah,
or as if we have to do that. And what you really need is peace with God.
That's right.
You need a place to come and move away from the world, if you like, for that moment. And it should be that other place. Yeah. I'm going to throw in one here because, and probably you haven't had as much experience of this as I have. I used to work in Christian radio, and I have to say, one of the worst things for Christian image is Christian rock and roll.
Okay.
Talk about giving love a bad name.
This might need some, I'm open because I'm interested, because I'm actually a bit of a fan of the Christian rock and roll.
Yeah, look, I have favorites.
Depends on where and when and what context, but.
Yeah, look, I'm not talking about in the Mass. Can I just say that very clearly? I'm definitely not talking about it in Mass, and I don't think certain types of modern music work in Mass precisely because of the nature of the music and what it's for. Mm. We can get into that in another cast, but the what I'm talking about is that often things get sold because they're Christian, and when the problem I have with modern Christian rock, and if you look at all the charts of Christian rock over the last, say, two decades, almost all of it is this prosperity doctrine. Everything's la-la because I'm with Jesus. And what we need, I think, is more of the Alanis Morissette kind of the gritty, that's probably dating me there really, isn't it? Or the Joan Osborne, what if God was one of us? The kind of the U2's searching, anguished lyrics before they went all fluffy and sold it to us on iTunes. Basically, the kind of the gritty life sucks. How do we wrestle with suffering? How do we actually deal with the Christian music seems to be very upbeat and la-la. And I find that when people talk about, oh, let's get modern music into parishes, they don't mean let's have a really doleful sort of song about suffering. They want to be upbeat and happy la-la instead of something that's actually about substantial things.
Well, two things I'll say about that very quickly. The first is that you can find them. I will name drop Matt Maher.
Okay.
I think his music is precisely what you think it should be.
Yep.
I'd agree with that. People can meditate and have actual profound mental prayer based on the lyrics and the way his songs are constructed.
He's the only guy I know who's written a song with transubstantiation in it.
As the opening line, end of the beginning is a great album. And that's dating me. I actually went to the first Matt Maher concert in Australia.
Right.
It was at a parish hall in Ashfield. Right? And I'm not kidding. And there were not that many people there, but we were going hard and there were chairs at the back with these old people just sitting there at the back and, you know, and he was like, get up and come to the front. And Australians, we're just like, No, we're just going to sit. We're okay. But so, yeah, I think you can find it.
Yep.
There's plenty of the happy clappy kind of stuff out there, but you can find within that genre some music that, you know, that really can orient you towards a prayerful engagement with, you know, with the transcendent. The second thing is about your point to say that, oh, we need to get, you know, music into churches that are going to attract young people. No young person says that.
Right.
You will never find a young person, at least in my experience, who will say, yeah, we need to get rid of all the old stuff. No one likes this ancient, what's polyphony? What's Gregorian chant? Yep. No one wants that. Get us the rock music. Like, I think that's more, if I can label the baby boomer generation as one particular culprit who says, we need, you know, this is what young people want. Mate, you have no idea what we want.
Yeah, don't actually ask young people what they want. And where are young people going in Sydney, at least?
Yep.
They're going to where there is beautiful traditional music.
Absolutely.
So that's where you will find young people today.
My kids are into the chart music, right? They're unfortunately, and I'm constantly having this discussion with them about quality of music and the variance and composition. But when I took them to our present church, the building, the architecture, the beautiful liturgy, it's very, very, I mean, it's Novus Ordo, it's the new Mass, but it's very well done.
So just Novus Ordo means it's in English, it's not in Latin.
That's right.
Yeah.
Confusing, because the Latin Mass is in Latin.
But it doesn't necessarily mean it's in English. The vernacular in Latin. So
Novus Ordo just means new order, because it's actually in Latin if we do it the right way. But mostly it's in English these days.
Yeah, that's right. This is just for anyone who's wondering what on earth we're talking about right now.
It means we're not into we're not talking about the old rite.
Yeah, that's right.
So basically it's the current mass but really done beautifully. And they all loved it. And I said, well, hang on, you don't like the other music? And they're saying, well, we come to church.
There's a time and a place for this music.
Yeah. And they would still. I mean, I think they do enjoy Matt Maher. In fact, we use his CDs. We use another guy called Toby Mac and DC Talk before that. I love them. They're well produced. They're really hard hitting. They actually, I'd like to quote a Toby Mac song, a DC Talk song actually at the end of this. They quote Bernard Banning saying, actually, I'll do it now. They quote Bernard Banning who said, the greatest cause of atheism in the world today is Christians who acknowledge Jesus with their lips and then deny him, walk out the door and deny him by their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And when someone's prepared to actually sort of wrestle with that problem, and that's the beginning of a song of DC Talk's called What If I Stumble? So they're not blaming other people for messing up the Christian thing. They're saying, what happens when I mess up? What happens when I destroy a relationship or when I, through my zealousness or just being an idiot, mess people's impression of a church? How do I actually deal with that? Well, I think it comes down to the local level though, doesn't it? I mean, the way we combat people who have had bad experiences or had bad impressions from the world is that we give them another experience.
Yeah, totally.
A different experience.
Agree.
And your example of the joyful, water cooler chat is exactly what we're talking about. And I think Renee's had lots of experience with this when we're talking with people who aren't religious at all, when they're in the classroom and they realize, hey, we're interested in engaging with all ideas openly and vigorously and not just saying you have to believe this, but we're actually exploring the ideas and this is a respectful exchange of ideas. They really get into that and they start respecting it much more. Yeah. Would you say that's the...
Yeah, I think that's true.
Hmm. Well, so pretty much it stops with us. The only way we're going to change it is actually be the change.
Well, that's totally my attitude. One particular scriptural image that I like reflecting on a lot of the time is, again, I'm going to be the guy that can't actually reference where it is in scripture, but it's the story where the two men are standing before the temple. One is the Pharisee and the other is just the humble tax collector.
Yep.
And yeah, the Pharisee is, dressed beautifully and the tax collector's, I imagine him as being quite, interiorly at least, but an artist would probably capture him as being filthy or something like that.
He's probably well dressed because he's very rich.
He is probably. That's all.
It's actually, just spiritually.
Spiritually, though.
Yeah.
And I kind of read my life as a tension between those two personalities.
Yep.
I'm trying to be like the tax collector in spirit, but I find myself a lot of the time more like, the Pharisee and declaring, well, aren't I fantastic?
This is exactly what I was talking about before. The words of the Pharisee in that one are, have mercy on me, a sinner. That's the word the Pharisee literally says in his prayer, have mercy on me, a sinner, whereas the words of the tax collector.
Yeah.
And the words of the Pharisee are, I thank God that I am not like other men, like this tax collector.
Look at that guy.
Yeah. And this is why in the liturgy, one of the very first things we come across is, Lord, have mercy. Mm. And it's the cry of a beggar, that we come before God as the beggar who says, all right, I'm the problem here. I'm the first problem to solve. And we talked about Mother Teresa before. Mother Teresa, when she was asked, what's the problem with the church? She said, me. Now,
she also said, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family.
Yes. Mm.
So I think that's a really important thing too. A lot of people can actually forget about how important that family life is. And I think anyone who's leading a professional life really needs to realize that well, that sometimes we can get so caught up in our work that we're actually forgetting the most important work,
culpa,
if you like.
Mea culpa. Yeah, you're welcome. Maxim.
We work together. We're, cut from the same cloth in that respect. So that tendency to want to go out and change the world needs to be really balanced, counterbalanced with just really loving one's family and working on what's going on there.
When I was in ministry, the Lutheran minister, a parishioner took me aside, very old and wise lady, and she said, Pastor, what if God had told me that there were just two people in the world that I should evangelize? What if he'd clearly told me two people, but I'm distracted by all the other good things I could do? I said, well, if God's telling you to evangelize those two people, you should go and do it. And she said, go home and play with your children. And she said, you're doing all these good things, but you have children at home and they need you.
Yeah.
And it bang, right in the heart. Yeah. Yeah. And it was such a, it's one of the reasons, by the way, I'm against married clergy is because I've experienced it myself. And literally you have two brides, you have the church and you have your own family, and you can't give them yourself completely, either one. And you end up doing a bad job of one or both, usually both. We are getting to the end of our discussion, unless you wanted to add anything more to that.
No, it's good.
We're not so eager to talk about bad things, are we?
Too joyful.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's time to wrap up. So at this time we're going to talk about something a bit more positive, something which has just made us wonder. We call this segment 1 Minute Wonder, where we talk about something in life which has made us stop and smile or think or just wonder about what God's given us. So let's start with our guest, Cormac.
Sure. Mine. 1 Minute Wonder for today actually really beautifully ties into how you just finished that point about going home and loving your family. I had a really interesting insight. You could call it perhaps a moment of divine inspiration. I don't know. But I have two boys with our third child, you know, due in a couple of weeks. So it's a very exciting time. But Patrick, who's my eldest, it's a totally new experience. Every time he's, you know, the next month he's doing different things. And so it's like, oh, I've got.
How old is he?
He's turning 3 in a few weeks.
Right. Okay.
So it's a chaotic kind of process, but he's such a dutiful, reasonable toddler. It's incredible. Wow. Like, and he's such an.
I don't think I've heard those words in the same sentence.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing, and he's really. He's really rules oriented, like he gets it, and he's so obedient, I think. And so when I engage with him and he's doing something, he's mucking up, and I go, oh, Patrick, you know, maybe let's not do that. Let's do something else, or you've hurt your brother. Can you say sorry? And when he, I want to look after him, and I'm giving him these boundaries because I know that that's good for him. I'm a father looking out for him and saying, look, you want to do this, but I'm putting that limit there to protect you.
Yeah.
And then when he turns around and says, "Yes, Daddy, I'm sorry. I'll do better next time." Almost is what he pretty much says. My heart just pours out with affection for him, and I just want how much more do I just want to look after him and hold him close? And I just it just hit me there. That must be how God looks at us.
Oh wow!
That when I'm obedient,
yep.
to God, you know. I'll start with when I am disobedient, he still loves me and he's putting safeguards in place to look after me.
Yep.
When I am obedient, how much must his heart pour out with affection?
But you just point out there, it's not just the slavish adherence to a particular rule. What you're seeing in your son there is something coming from his heart.
That's right.
Yeah, where his heart aligns with the ideals and stuff you're talking about. And that's when obedience is I'm being technical here. Obedience is not just slavish, like adherence to a particular set of rules, but it's when their hearts align with what we're.
It's precisely right. I'm not doing it because he's listened to me.
Yes,
it's more of an orientation of himself to say, yep, you've aligned with the vision that I have for your good.
Yeah,
and you are living that and embodying that. And so I just
cool.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Cool. That was slightly more than a minute, but Renee.
Sorry.
That's right. All right. It's fine. It was a good story.
It's your first time.
You're never welcome again.
1 minute. Well, this week I have been putting together lots of stuff for teachers who will be teaching high school students about Catholic thought. And I'm a philosopher, and I always joke and I say I have to get myself a t-shirt that says, I am not a theologian, because often I get asked theology questions, but actually I've had to read a lot into theology these days, so I'm starting to question whether the t-shirt is now okay or not. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I've been looking at the Trinity. So that is a cause
That's
for
a good
wonder.
Start.
It's a really cause for wonder. And trying to give visual aids to teachers who will be teaching high school students, I looked really seriously at Rublev's icon of the Trinity.
Oh, yeah.
And just so much opened up, and I just found so much about the geometry of the whole piece, but just the beautiful way in which Rublev was taking something from the book of Genesis, so with Abraham, and from the book of John, and talking about unity and multiplicity. And that has really struck me a lot as something that as a church I think we need to be far more serious about realizing in our everyday lives.
So it's amazing how much the Trinity actually has bearing on everything we do.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wonder if that image is out of copyright so we can put a cop, like
well,
a
I
link
found
to
a
it.
Wikimedia public domain kind of thing.
Well, if it's public domain, we could probably put it in the show notes. Yeah. So that'd be worth following up. My 1 minute wonder was that I got the opportunity to ride in my normal, regular train ride to work, but my children were on their way to a ferry ride. So three of my children, I've got to be careful. Yeah, three of my children came with. Four of my children came with.
Losing track.
on the train, and my wife was with us. But I sat next to my youngest daughter, and just her sheer joy and wonder at all the things I look at every day with that bland kind of, I'm on my way to work. And she was, wow, look at that. What's that? What's that bit? And I just, it's now changed my, on the way here this morning, I was looking at all the things going, I'll tell her more about that tomorrow. It's just changed my perception. And kids do that for you. You start seeing the whole world in a different way.
That reminds me of in Fides et Ratio when John Paul II talks about the importance of wonder and how we can fall into deadening routine if we don't constantly keep that sense of wonder alive.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there you go.
I'm reading a book. Still reading a book. It's a very short one, but I'm taking a long time. It's called The Theology of Wonder. It's based on G.K. Chesterton's look at the world, so we'll have to come back to that sometime.
Yeah, totally. I'd be interested.
Yeah.
Excellent. <You'll have> me.
That's it for this week's podcast. If today's discussion got you thinking or arguing with us or you think we missed something, let us know. You can subscribe to our podcast at our website, thiscatholiclife.com.au, and tell us what you liked or what you didn't like and what you'd like us to discuss in future. You can drop us a line at info@thiscatholiclife.com.au, or you can continue the conversation by joining our Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Discord, or any of the other regular social medias. The links are all in the show notes and on our website. If you like the podcast, be sure to write us a review on iTunes. Remember, you have to sign in these days into iTunes Player and then leave the review. This helps other people who are looking for similar things to find us, and also helps us, obviously, if you give us feedback. This is a uniquely Australian Catholic podcast, and we think that's a great idea, and we think it's an idea worth getting behind. So tell your friends about it. But before we go, it's time for shout-outs. Is anyone you wanted to say hi to, Cormac?
Oh, James Tedesco, if he's listening, to say thanks for getting the Blues home in State of Origin. The Blues being New South Wales in State of Origin.
There you go. I was there watching it, and I'm told it was an awesome match, and I could see the scoreline was quite tight, but I won't pretend to have understood much of it. So, Renee.
I have no idea what you guys were just talking about, but I'd like to send a shout out to all of the wonderful people who work in a really quiet way to help the vulnerable within our church. So I'm constantly amazed, especially around wintertime, at all of the Vinnie's appeals that go out, and just all of that wonderful, very quiet work that which does not reach the headlines of the newspapers. And I'm sure that a lot of people who do that work wouldn't want that to be the case, but I admire them greatly, and shout out to them if they're listening.
Yeah. I'd like to shout out to the Catholic parents I've had an opportunity to speak to recently, but they're all trying their hardest to do a good job of being parents, and it's a tough gig, and usually they think they're doing a bad job, which probably means they've actually got a good attitude and they're thinking about the hard things. But you're actually doing much better than you think. Keep up the hard work, and basically you can only do as much as you have the capacity to do. Keep trying. That's all for this week. Next week we're going to discuss how difficult it is to find true love as a Catholic. We'll hear from the author of For Want of a Lot of Good Men, the article in the Catholic Weekly, which exploded with interest and lots of responses to that. We'll discuss the amazing reaction to that article and more. That's all for now. Thank you for listening to This Catholic Life.